Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Lift the burden of getting a home loan with Rocket Mortgage and get a secure, transparent home loan approval in minutes. Skip the bank, skip the waiting, and go completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. There's a lot the U.S. government does that the average American citizen isn't supposed to know about. Spy missions, overseas intrigue, quiet military operations in foreign lands. And for decades, research into extrasensory perception, remote viewing, seeing the future, exploring the psychic unknown for the Department of Defense and CIA. It was all very X-Files, and it's not over. This hour, On Point, the untold history of the U.S. government's long investigation into the psychic powers of the mind. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Do you know how far your government's gone into the psychic realm? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We're looking at a new book today, but pieces of this have been out there for a while. This goes back to 1995, a little tape here. The CIA formally canceled its Stargate, or remote viewing research program, leading to a wave of public condemnation of that spending and confusion about what they'd been up to. In November 1995, an episode of ABC's Nightline, here reporter Michael Dillon details the U.S. government's initial efforts into remote viewing.
At the height of the Cold War, everyone was worried about keeping up with the Soviets. There was the bomber gap, the missile gap, and then there was the ESP gap. Reports that the Soviets were using psychics to spy on us prompted us to do the same to them.
And there you go, Stargate and all the rest. That's what we knew in 1995. Let's see what we know now. Joining me from NPR West in Culver City, California, is Annie Jacobson, author of the new book, Phenomena, The Secret History of the U.S. Government's Investigation into Extrasensory Perception and Psychokinesis. She's also author of The Pentagon's Brain, Area 51, Operation Paperclip. Annie Jacobson, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
It's a big book. It's kind of gripping. Some of these details blew my mind. What did you tap into that we haven't known so far, Annie?
I think the biggest surprise for me was to learn that these programs that have been going on for decades are still going on today. And I came across that while I was researching my last book, The Pentagon's Brain, working in this arena of hard military science and learning about how the Defense Department was working to push science in this arena called nanobio-neurotechnology. I mean, that field of work didn't exist 10 years ago because it involves putting tiny electronic chips in the brains of soldiers who've had a brain injury in war. And the point was to be able to look inside their brain and see what was going on. In that research, I found the Office of Naval Research was working on a program with anomalous cognition, not brain injury, but anomalous cognition. That is a fancy 21st century word for extrasensory perception, or ESP.
And they're out there working on this. I mean, you got in and talked to people who are talking within the military today about premonition, intuition, spidey sense, and actually trying to teach active duty U.S. Marines to hone their precognitive skills, i.e., to sense what's coming before it happens.
Absolutely. I mean, these are ideas that have been around since across recorded history. They've been lionized. They've been vilified. People who work in them get ridiculed. They get put on a pedestal. I mean, listen to your I heard your clip. It's right there. You hear that kind of snickering about how could the government spend this kind of money. And yet we do. We continue to do this. And as a journalist researching this long 70-year history from an objective, neutral position, or at least trying to, I marveled at what I learned. My mind was essentially opened to some of these ideas that I had been closed-minded about previously. And to me, that is the heart of journalism. You know, you present the facts in a way in which, hopefully, people can make up their own minds about what they think of all of this.
Help us understand just from the get-go of your title, because some of these terms had more currency, I think, a couple decades ago than they have now. I mean, even ESP, I remember a time when everybody was talking about extrasensory perception. Now, I don't hear much about it often. And then psychokinesis, that too, way back in the late show. I mean, Johnny Carson had guys on there bending spoons. It was a big deal. I hear less about it now. But what does extrasensory perception mean? What does psychokinesis mean?
So extrasensory perception, ESP, is essentially the sixth sense. It's the idea that information could be garnered from a means other than the five known senses. Psychokinesis is the alleged ability to move or influence matter with the mind. And you're absolutely right about these old ideas from the 70s. That has to do with nomenclature. I mean, in the modern era, people don't want to use any of those terms like ESP and psychokinesis because they have this heavy sort of stigma attached to them. There's some kind of anachronistic idea from the past. And that's why I was so fascinated to learn the Defense Department today is calling these programs, you know, spidey sense, as you said, or anomalous cognition, because they have a currency to them that allows people to go, oh, wait a minute, that's interesting, let me look at that. And it gets rid of that old idea, or rather the stigma of ESP.
You suggest that in some ways this may be intersecting with developments in technology in an interesting way, and I want to come to that. But take us back first. How did this get into the bloodstream of the U.S. government? I mean, we associate, if you go way back, this was sort of seances in the 19th century, sitting around a table and, you know, do I hear someone's spirit or fortune-telling? How did this begin to come into the U.S. government realm?
So as a reporter who writes about war and weapons, and having written four books on this, I'm amazed that sort of all roads in the modern Defense Department, in the modern era of the CIA, lead back to the Nazis. And this research is no different, meaning the Nazis had a department that was working on these exact what would be called pseudoscience pursuits. Heinrich Himmler was running the office. And at the end of the war, our intelligence services captured a big trove of the documents. They were called Das Annenerbe. And also some of these weird artifacts that Himmler was using to pursue this pseudoscience. And so it might have ended there, except for the fact that the Soviets captured the other half of the Das Annenerbe documents, and there began the psychic arms race against the other superpower of the Cold War.
I mean, it's fascinating. The Germans were really into this. You've got some amazing detail on that. During the war, almanacs and calendars and dates and astrological information. I've got a little clip here. This is from during World War II. The British Secret Service, MI6, was actively involved in planting fake psychic warnings and messages to high-ranking members of the Nazi elite in Germany. And here's a little footage from the documentary The Age of Psychics by Don Como. Astrologer John Manalesco talks about that World War II effort to mess with this German interest on behalf of the British here.
We falsified almanacs and calendars, and we printed leaflets with twisted astrological information to influence psychologically the German population. These leaflets were dropped by the millions over German cities, German naval installations, and so forth. And we had excellent reports from Germany that this was a major demoralizing factor, especially in the later part of the war.
There, the British, during the war, trying to manipulate German interest in this realm. But after the war, Annie, Americans and Soviets really jumping on this.
I mean, I love that clip, and it really speaks to kind of the cultural mindset of the day, which sometimes you feel changes, and other times you feel like it's the same old story dressed up in a different outfit. Mm-hmm. I mean, all of this can be used for disinformation, for misinformation, and because
for quackery,
you're talking about,
I mean, it can come in.
Perhaps, This is a world peopled by charlatans and snake oil salesmen. There is no doubt about that. And the Defense Department and the CIA use that to their advantage to keep programs hidden. But one should not throw out the baby with the bathwater. And I certainly detail that in Phenomena, showing readers, I hope, how some of this is disinformation, but a lot of it has the CIA and the Defense Department baffled, literally saying to themselves, what is going on?
There's always a latent interest, and sometimes not so latent. You describe how this group of very wealthy women in Camden, Maine, which was a sort of summer playground for the wealthy. This is Astor's and DuPont's and Borden and Forbes. Scions had an interest in this early on, and even before the government, they were funding research into this realm.
You know, I really got a lucky reporter's break with those documents, which I located in the Library of Congress, and I don't think had been seen by anyone since they'd been written. They sort of chronicle this work of a very interesting doctor named Andrea Puharik, who was both a CIA asset, and he was a doctor at the Army Chemical Center, working in this idea that you could give people drugs to enhance their extrasensory perception powers. Puharich was also spending summers and long months at that enclave you mentioned in Maine with these extraordinarily wealthy benefactors of his. And they were pursuing these ideas about whether or not extrasensory perception, psychokinesis, map dowsing, was something that was biological, was something inside the human physiology, or if it was something supernatural, if it was something that came from without. And that's why this whole world is so laden with skepticism, with, you know, incendiary talk, because that's where you get into the realm of, you know, the scientific skeptic saying, wait a minute, this is all nonsense.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about the untold story, largely, of how the U.S. government invested millions in psychics, in mental telepathy, clairvoyance, precognition, and more during the Cold War and beyond, into ESP and spoonbenders, third-eye visionaries, to see the future, see through walls, try to bend the world with the mind. Annie Jacobson writes it up in her big new book, Phenomena, The Secret History of the U.S. Government's Investigation into Extrasensory Perception and Psychokinesis. You can join us this hour. Can you picture U.S. naval officers hoping to communicate between submarines with ESP, searching for psychedelic mushrooms in Mexico to power all this? Are you a believer, willing to believe, to consider? Is this too X-file-y for you? Were you part of the experiments? They went on a long time. Were you asked to peer from afar into Tehran basements and Soviet submarine bases? And he quotes the CIA in 1975 saying, this is the CIA, a large body of reliable experimental evidence points to the inescapable conclusion that extrasensory perception does exist as a real phenomenon. That was your CIA 1975. 1981? You had remote viewing groups. That year, U.S. Brigadier General James Dozier was kidnapped out of his home in Verona, Italy, by members of an Italian paramilitary group. And the kidnapping had been predicted and seen, the government believed, by the U.S. Army's remote viewing specialist group, described here in a 2014 interview with former U.S. Army remote viewer Joe McGonigal.
There was another remote viewer in our group who described how he was being held. The fact that he was being held in a mock tent that was constructed inside the room, that he was chained to a radiator, that they were playing rock music through headsets taped to his head, and he was being kept permanently blindfolded. All of these things turned out to be absolutely true.
Annie Jacobson joins us from California. Annie, what's remote viewing? And did everybody in the Army believe that they had a group of seers who had seen that before they found the guy?
Oh, goodness, no. But remote viewing is a fancy term for ESP that was created by the CIA in the early 70s to remove that occult stigma from ESP. But the controversy that arose with this was extraordinary, and it makes for such great research and reporting, I found, because there's always this battle going on between the two sides. Those who absolutely are in the work and experience what are called conversion moments, where they have an experience that they suddenly feel this extreme conviction that ESP exists. The CIA's term for it was actually 8 martini results, and that's because a CIA analyst, often a skeptic, would sit with a psychic in a Faraday cage, an electronically shielded room, and put them to a test. And what would be revealed to them by the psychic was so remarkable, the CIA analyst would have to go home and have 8 martinis to recover from whatever it was.
On the other hand, oh my gosh, I can't believe what I just saw and heard.
I mean, absolutely became a slogan, the 8 martini results. And yet, on the other side, you have scientific skeptics who loathe anything having to do with this subject. They find it charlatanism at its greatest. And, you know, there's real value in looking at the fact that the phenomena, if you will, is not repeatable. And that's the real beef that the scientific skeptics have with it, rightly so. It does not pass scientific method muster, which is that you must be able to consistently repeat an experiment in a laboratory for it to be called science.
But there were,
and that's not the case.
I totally get that. But there were developments here that made people really wonder. Tell us the story. We just heard Joe McGonigal there. He was involved in this, trying to figure out the Soviet submarine thing. Tell us that story. This became the basis for Tom Clancy's The Hunt for Red October, this super submarine. There was remote viewing that went on? What happened there?
Well, that is a remarkable story, and it's sort of in the annals of the Pentagon nomenclature, which is called an intelligence first. That's when no other intelligence collection means satellites, spy planes, etc., human intelligence, are able to gather the information that the Pentagon is after, and then a psychic comes along and gets it for them.
What was the setting? What did Joe see?
The setting was they were trying – the spy satellites had revealed that the Soviets were building this colossal warehouse sort of 150 meters back from the shoreline. And the Defense Department did not know what was going on inside of it and needed to. McMonagle comes in, gives these sessions, and again, these are declassified CIA documents that are remarkable. And he's able to describe a giant – submarine, which is later the Typhoon. I mean, in exquisite detail. And he even gets the code name of it, the Russian word for shark. And the Defense Department writes this off. They say, this guy has no idea what he's talking about. I mean, why the heck would they build something away from the shore? They always build submarines in canals right up abutting the shore. Well, McMonagle said, I also see some kind of weird canal, like a Dutch canal. And they wrote it off. Lo and behold, a couple months later, what appears... But this Typhoon in this naval shipyard.
Typhoon, the name of this super submarine.
Super submarine made famous by Tom Clancy in The Hunt for Red October. And that canal was what was then flooded with water. The warehouse was opened and the Typhoon was brought down that channel to the shore. It was meant to confuse the Americans. And McMonagle got this information by means that is inexplicable and certainly not gathered by any of the five senses, leading the Defense Department to conclude the sixth sense can give us an intelligence first.
The one that just really blew my mind went back to the hostage crisis in Tehran in 1979. And, of course, we all imagined that all sorts of resources were being brought to bear there when so many Americans were taken hostage as the Islamic Revolution took over Iran. And it was the bane of Jimmy Carter's presidency and essentially ended it. And the whole country focused on this. But you describe in great detail about how – well, tell us, who was it in the government who had this squad of remote viewers sitting in the United States trying to visualize with ESP, I guess, where the hostages were and their circumstances? What?
That's right. Well, the army had the program at that point. It had been taken over from the CIA by the army. And the client was the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And when the hostages were taken, there was a big confusion about who exactly was a hostage. There were a lot of assets in Tehran at the time, and the government was scrambling to find out who is not hostage and who is. And the remote viewers successfully identified these individuals. Again, the declassified documents speak for themselves. And so at that point, the remote viewers were kind of taken on to try and help the Joint Chiefs of Staff when the rescue attempt was going on in April of the following year.
Now, slow down a little bit. Where were these remote viewers? I mean, was this on a military base, or were they deployed like a platoon? How did it work?
So they were located at Fort Meade in Maryland, and they had their own buildings, and it was a special access program, meaning it had extremely strict classified protocols, so no one really knew what was going on in those two buildings that they occupied, but those who were cleared on the program. And their clients, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the defense, you know, the FBI, the Secret Service, the National Security Council, would task them with operations and say, okay, find out this for us. And the remote viewers, as I chronicle in Phenomena, would then sit in these, you know, electronically shielded room trying to gather this information through the Sixth Sense. And sometimes they would be taken off base into an even more secret environment, as was the case during the Tehran hostage crisis, because their information was seen by the Joint Chiefs of Staff as so valuable, and they wanted to seclude them the way sort of a jury is secluded from any public information that might interfere with their perceptions.
Now, Jimmy Carter tried to rescue those hostages. The helicopters that were sent in met a bad end in the desert. It did not work out well. It was a fiery end. And you describe these remote viewers using ESP and becoming anticipating this, just kind of describing it. And I don't know how seriously to take this, but tell us what you report.
Well, again, these are declassified CIA and Defense Department documents that I received through a Freedom of Information Act request, and they chronicle the actual, you know, logs of what was happening, and they are truly remarkable, and I didn't know what to make of it. I mean,
what happened? What do they see? Who? What?
Well, the remote viewers did not know, no one knew, certainly in that army unit, that the rescue attempt was going to go on. And as you recall, it was a huge debacle in the desert with, you know, fire and helicopters crashing and death, and it was just a disaster. And the remote viewers in real time were being asked to witness something that was going on. They did not know what. And when you read through these reports, as I narrate in the book, about what they were seeing, I mean, it's really remarkable. And they, you know, one of them begins crying and throws her, gets up and says, I can't do this anymore. It's something horrible. They're confused. I interviewed a number of people.
Describes a huge explosion.
Absolutely. I mean, someone was describing, you know, gorillas running through the desert. And this is where you get into that other parapsychological idea that these are gestalts that people are seeing. I mean, it's really wild stuff. But out of it are some of these remarkable details that really leave you scratching your head.
And here was Jimmy Carter. This was addressing The Nation about that failed mission, April 25th, 1980. Eight servicemen dead, no hostages rescued, but many members of the U.S. Army's remote viewing intelligence operation had kind of, it was thought, seen this desert failure from their isolation. Here was the president.
As president, I know that our entire nation feels a deep gratitude, I feel, for the brave men who were prepared to rescue their fellow Americans from captivity. And as president, I also know that the nation shares not only my disappointment that the rescue effort could not be mounted because of mechanical difficulties, but also my determination to persevere and to bring all of our hostages home to freedom.
Annie Jacobs gives us the Annie Jacobs and the sort of psychic backstory to that in her book Phenomena. Annie, we're going to talk in a moment with Hal Puthoff, who was at Stanford and did a lot, oversaw a lot of this research. He's going to join us in just a second. Introduce him for us. What role did he play?
Hal Puthoff was the original physicist sought out by the CIA in the early 1970s to run the program. He had run the sort of psychic program, if you will. He had
the research.
A top secret. Yes. He had a top secret clearance already, and he was open to some of these ideas, meaning they felt that he was willing to work in an arena that most scientists would reject for fear of how they might be perceived if the program ever became public. And he did remarkable things with the program, and what I find fascinating about Hal Puthoff is that all these years later, he remains with his top secret clearances, and he continues to work in the arena. And much of that he cannot talk about today because of classification issues. But he remains one of the longest continually cleared Defense Department scientists that I have ever interviewed.
He's with us right now from Austin, Texas, a former program director of the Stanford Research Institute, where he led programs conducting remote viewing research for the Department of Defense, U.S. intelligence agencies. He's now president and CEO of EarthTech International. Hal Puthoff in Austin, Texas, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. I'm glad to be here.
I'm sure over these many decades you've dealt with belief and skepticism. I don't know in what proportion. How do you deal with the fact that the work that you've put so much effort into and did for such a long time, gets this range of responses from believers to absolute skeptics?
Well, that's certainly a good description. In fact, we have a sort of a mantra. There are two responses to the idea of remote viewing and ESP, and that's that those who try it know it works, and those who don't know it can't. So we've dealt with that from the very beginning. Fortunately, science is a self-correcting enterprise, so a scientist like myself and my colleagues, we just let the data lead us. And so in that sense, we have a very strong ground to stand on, because we know that if we follow the data, it'll tell us what's true, what's not true, and it really doesn't matter what other people's opinions are.
Let me go to John, who's calling from Lincoln, Massachusetts. John, you're on the air. Thank you very much for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. I don't know what data is leading this scientist. I'm a biologist, not a physicist.
Okay.
But the laws of physics, as we know them, clearly say psychic ability cannot happen. Physics knows the particles that we are made of. They know the particles that our mind functions via, and they cannot do psychic phenomena. And while they don't say that they know every particle that will be discovered, any other particles that they might discover will disappear so fast they can't have any effect, or they're so weak they can't have any interaction with us.
John, hold the thought. Hal Puthoff, what do you say to that? Here's a biologist who says physics says no way, no how.
Well, he has a good point in what he thinks. And, of course, as physicists, we were very interested in trying to figure out the mechanism. One of the hypotheses was that it was ELF, low-frequency brainwave kinds of signals. So we decided to test that in a number of ways. We did long-distance experiments, thinking that if it really was just ELF brainwaves, they would fade over distance, and we didn't see any evidence for that. We then did experiments in which we used smaller and smaller targets, even down to microdots, knowing that if it was brainwave frequencies with long wavelengths, there's no way someone's going to get the resolution of a microdot. And then finally, we put some of our people on board a submersible that went down into the bottom of the ocean, where we had a ton of seawater that was conductive and therefore made a great shield at those frequencies. And the function still worked there. So basically, although we never figured out exactly what physics was involved, we were able to at least eliminate brainwave frequencies as being the carrier. But in response to your caller, another thing to take into account is that although there's no direct evidence for exactly how it's working, we know that when you get into the very deep fundamentals of quantum theory, you've got things like entanglement, where you have correlations over large distances. So there are pathways to explore, and they are being explored. So it's we haven't gotten there yet. It's not yet known yet, whether there are some additional fields and forces that we're not aware of, or whether it's when we understand the forces we do know about at a deeper level, it may emerge exactly what the mechanisms are.
Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, it's important to work with someone you can trust who has your best interests in mind. With Rocket Mortgage, you get a transparent online process that gives you the confidence you need to make an informed decision. Skip the bank, skip the waiting, and go completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the untold story of how the U.S. government invested millions in psychics, in mental telepathy, clairvoyance, precognition, and more during the Cold War and beyond into ESP and spoonbenders and third-eye visionaries to see the future, see through walls, try to bend the world with the mind. Annie Jacobson writes about it all in her new book, Phenomena. She joins us from NPR West in Culver City, California. What do you make of these stories and this long pursuit by the U.S. government, especially after World War II, in the Cold War in competition with the Soviets, to see what was here, if something was here, how it might be applied, and to the word that this is still going on today, advanced perceptual competences, a phrase we now hear from the U.S. military. Annie Jacobson is with us. Hal Puthoff is with us as well. He was former program director at the Stanford Research Institute, where a lot of this research went on. He's now president and CEO of EarthTech International. Joins us from Austin, Texas. Tom is calling from Burlington, Wisconsin. Hi, Tom. You're on the air. Thank you for calling.
They say musicians can get into the theta area of the brain. You go from alpha, beta, theta. So musicians can get into this psychic zone. And my experience was I have a little shack over here, and before 9/11, I had this intense feeling of something dreadful happening. And 12 hours later, they had the planes went into the towers. But it turns out the man who is across the road from me, he was the engineer who went down there and worked on both those airplanes. He cleared one of the planes, the American airline, to go over to London, and he had put the engine into the other plane that flowing into the towers. And then right around on the other side of the airport, Don lost his nephew from New York and his nephew from California. The nephew from California had come in to have lunch with his, to breakfast with his cousin, and they were both killed. But this feeling of dread, it's a kind of a precognition or something or other.
Tom, I see a note here that your dad was actually influential in some of the U.S. government spending on this. What was his role?
My father was a member of the Defense Committee and the Appropriations Committee, so every dollar
he was a congressman.
The Defense Committee had to come through him.
Okay.
He was a congressman, Charles Boyle from Illinois, and he said, you wouldn't believe the kind of programs that we finance here. If you come up with a proposal, even today, if you come up with a good proposal, you'll get the money for it.
On this psychic front, and then you went on to feel that you had some kind of premonition yourself before 9/11. Annie Jacobson, a lot of people are asking us online here, saying, give us some more examples of how this has been applied through these decades and when U.S. government officials thought it worked.
Yes. These situations were used in all kinds of intelligence collections and also Defense Department operations.
Like
so
what?
They were locating hostages. They were locating fugitives. They were finding downed aircraft. They were finding, in one situation that was remarkable to me, during the war on drugs, when the Defense Department was mobilized to try and interdict big loads of cocaine coming into the United States, they put the Pentagon's remote viewers on the job, and lo and behold, some of these individuals could actually pinpoint where in a cargo hold on a specific ship the cocaine was located. Again, from declassified documents that leave you scratching your head, having that feeling of the 8 Martini moment where you go, how does this work?
Mike in Evansville, Indiana. Mike, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks, Tom. This whole ESP investigation reminds me of that old Clever Hans horse that people used to think could count and perform other intellectual tasks. Hmm. And then they do these thorough investigations, and then they find out that the horse is actually using other clues that people aren't aware of. And I'm thinking, you know, we as people at all levels of government and even in the sciences are easily fooled, and sometimes we use cues that we're not aware of. And I'm just thinking, it's great that they investigate things like this, but it's also important that this type of investigation be reproducible and verified by other scientists, other investigators.
I appreciate your call very much, Mike. How put off have you been fooled all these years?
If I might add into this, mm-hmm. Without a doubt, the kind of thing you just said about the horse and so on is certainly true. But there are many experiments that were done. For example, one of the big challenges that we always got was, well, if these people are so psychic, why ain't they rich? So, in fact, we picked up on a challenge like that. And we had a group of remote viewers go into the silver futures market for 30 days. And collectively made $260,000. Now, there's a case where, you know, getting unexpected body cues or whatever, you know, it just doesn't handle the data. So there are many cases in particular for, and especially in some of the intelligence operations where, for example, the bomber went down in Zaire, and no one knew where it was. The Russians were trying to get it back because it was their bomber. We were trying to get it because we knew it had sensitive electronics on board. And so our remote viewers, they had the whole continent of Africa to try to figure out where it was. And they worked on it and put an X within a couple of miles of where the aircraft was. And so our teams went in and they were able to get the aircraft before the Russians found it. So in some situation like that, it isn't the case that somebody who's, quote, doing a test knows what the answer is and might lead the remote viewer. Most of the operational work was done on targets and requirements where no one who was on our side had any clue as to what the answer was, and it was only after the fact that we were able to find that the results were excellent.
Hal Putoff, please stand by there in Austin, Texas. Annie Jacobson in Culver City, California, author of the new book, Phenomena. It describes decades of research into extrasensory perception, psychokinesis, remote viewing, mental telepathy, and more. We have with us right now from Sebastopol, California, a woman who was involved in that research as a psychic and former participant in these research programs in precognition and clairvoyance. Gail Hasen joins us. Gail Hasen in Sebastopol, California. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Happy to be here.
It's great to have you. I should stipulate I've known you for a long time, Gail, so I've heard some of these stories. Then I saw Annie's book, and I thought, wow, that's what Gail's been talking about. What kind of research was done with you, Gail? I mean, you were one of the people who was called in and put through a battery of tests around this. Like what?
This is true. In 1998, I walked into the office of Dean Radin and Russell Targ at Interval Research in Palo Alto that my husband David had been working at, and he suggested me as a subject for them because they were looking for people to participate in experiments. So I decided to come down for the interview, and they interviewed me for a few hours, and I told them all the different psychic experiences I'd had since I was a little girl, and they said, we'd like to work with you and experiment with you on remote viewing and precognitive remote viewing, and there were these other tests. I can't remember. What was it with the fingertips? Anyways, there were many, many different tests that I did with them, and I'm still doing them to this day, so it's almost 20 years. I have to comment about the man who said he didn't feel that it was the proper proof or something.
Mm-hmm.
Recently, I was called into the Institute of Noetic Sciences, where Dean Radin is the senior scientist, and Russell was gathering information for a documentary that he created called, he produced, called Third Eye Spies, which is the history of the Stanford Research Project. And they asked me during this my feelings of what it was like to work with everyone, and I talked about it. And then they said, well, now we have a spontaneous thing we're going to ask you to do. And they sent out someone who I'd never seen, so I didn't know if it was a man or a woman, but there was someone walking around Petaluma with a GoPro camera on, and they sat me down and they said, okay, we want you to describe on paper where he is at 5 minutes. Well, we didn't know it was a he then, but where the person is at 5 minutes, 10 minutes, and 15 minutes.
Okay.
And when the filmmaker looked at all the information some months later, they discovered that exactly at the moment that this individual, who I met later after, at 15 minutes when he turned his head after I described exactly where he was standing in front of, he turned his head and looked up at a billboard. And exactly at the moment, since this is timed with GoPro cameras, they see me saying exactly when he turns his head, oh, gee, it's a board of colorful, boingy, squiggly things.
Okay.
Which is an unusual thing for a billboard to be.
Yeah.
But I have photos of it. This is exactly what the person was looking at. And I described it. I mean, one minute I'm describing a cafe and how he's standing in front of this building and it's yellow and there's all these things. And then all of a sudden I say, oh, squiggly, colorful, boingy things. Well, that's the exact moment he turned his head and saw that on a huge billboard in Petaluma.
And you can look back at the record of the GoPro camera and put the two clocks side by side. Gail, stand by. Annie Jacobson, here's Gail Hasen, who was brought in and, you know, put through the paces. And I guess this is one of many individuals that the U.S. government has worked with to try and figure what can we do here.
Well, I'm not familiar with her work, but I think that might be a civilian program. And one of the reasons I, as a national security reporter, am always writing on the access of declassified documents from the CIA and the Defense Department is then I can really look at the, you know, at this documentation that exists and work with the fact that there are certain protocols in place that remove any idea of cluing or cheating or etc. And so I specifically did not write about the civilian programs because I don't know how to verify, you know, to get secondary sources on them. What I did in Phenomena is I looked at the declassified documents and then I was able to interview all the psychics and scientists with top secret clearances who actually worked in these government programs.
Let me get a call from another Gail in Fish Creek, Wisconsin. Hi, Gail, you're on the air.
Hi. Oh, I loved hearing that the other Gail called in. That's phenomenal stuff. And we are phenomenal. And that's the issue is what I'm concerned with is there has to be a separation between this amazing gift and corruption that could be abused in government. Because there's still ego, there's still fears, there's still all of that human lower category of out there trying to one-up in the dangers. And as much as we would like to use it for good, we can't guarantee that governments would actually keep using it for good. And they would be abusing the psychic energies that the people are using because it does wear them out.
Let me take that to California, if I may, Gail. Gail Hasen, in California, I know you've had these psychic feelings throughout your life. Do you fear that once you put it to work for a government or a military, a Defense Department, CIA, that it could be used for ill?
Well, the two gentlemen that I've worked with, I trust implicitly, and I don't have any fears like anything I'm doing is going towards anything evil. In fact, I think they've been things that I've done to help people, exactly the opposite. I worked on a case. I didn't even know I could do these things, but I received a phone call of a missing person in Colorado that had been missing for 8 days. And I was able to see exactly where the person was, deceased in a car on the side of the road in a boulder. But when I described it all, some hours later, not because of my information particularly, but they happened to find exactly the situation I described. It gave some relief to the persons that were calling to find out that there was someone they could talk to. I found other experiences also where they may be small things, but they're things where you just, you know, the person knows you need some information and you have it there ready for them.
It's pretty amazing. Annie Jacobson, after all these decades, where does this stand now? Is it now in the category of, oh boy, we were infatuated with these things at one time and now we're not? Or Is it merging toward other technologies? Is it gaining credence within the government at this point, or losing any?
I think with the advent of this advanced technology that we're looking at today, the idea at the Defense Department is either we're going to be able to prove this has been a fool's errand, or we're really going to be able to move this hypothesis toward a general theory.
And when you say this, with the advanced technology, like what? That it may be...
Brain technology, neuro, nano, bio, brain technology.
I need to speak on that.
But to your caller's point, I think what's interesting, and again, I'm a national security reporter, the Defense Department is in the business of weapons. And so when speaking with Office of Naval Research scientists who are now using these programs, they're very clear that what they are doing is trying to figure out what the Spidey sense is, and then they are trying to model it, and then they are trying to, their word, accelerate it. And what accelerate means is weaponize. And so that distinction in the book I write, Phenomena, is a very clear and important distinction. Separate from that is whether or not this phenomena can be used in the civilian sector for other purposes.
But it is being, I mean, you report about some millions put just a couple of years ago into this by the Office of Naval Research, and Marines being trained in precognitive skills.
And these programs were born of actual situations in the war theater where a soldier says, we're not going down that road in Mosul. There's an IED buried. And the robot is sent out, and the IED goes off. Now that soldier becomes very interesting to the Defense Department. And his brain functioning is looked at to try and figure out what is that precognition concept that exists within that soldier that he was able to say that, which interestingly brings you back to that age-old idea of the phenomena, which has to do with divination, which has to do with knowing the future, which rulers and kings have been interested in since time immemorial.
Does this ever move out of the disputed realm and into the realm of commonly accepted fact, or is that just beyond what we can anticipate any?
I think more will be revealed.
Well, I want to thank all three of you, and I wish we had more time, but I'm very grateful to all of you. Hal Puthoff, who's now CEO of EarthTech International in Austin, Texas, was in charge of a lot of this at Stanford. Mr. Puthoff, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
Gail Hazen in Sebastopol, California, who's participated in so much of this research. Gail, thank you for giving us just a taste of what it was like to be there in the midst of some of this kind of research. Thanks so much, Gail.
You're so welcome. And please tell Annie she should look on the fact that we did do a brain experiment with an fMRI.
Got it. We're up against the clock. Annie Jacobson is author of Phenomena, The Secret History of the U.S. Government's Investigation into Extrasensory Perception and Psychokinesis. This is On Point.